We've got the gang all here. We've been studying the plans and the blueprints. We've got our escape route planned. And we're ready for the Heist Highlights episode. Follow us as we dip into the best heist movies. Join us.
Here is a motion picture film. Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel.
Listeners, and welcome to Film Swap. My name is David Seeley, and my esteemed co-host over here, codenamed the ecstatic gaucho himself, it's Jonathan Pritchard Barrett. Jono, how are you doing?
Doing very well, David. Great to be back.
It is indeed. It's been a few weeks since we've spoken because of the Easter break and such what, but it's good to see you. And we've got a really great theme tonight because we are talking about Heist Highlights.
We are.
The heist movie, a perennial favorite all throughout the history of cinema. I was actually thinking about that today, about when heist films really kind of started. And I was kind of thinking, it must have been kind of around the film noir sort of post-war sort of thing. But I don't know if that's true. I have no basis on which to make that assertion without doing some heavy research.
But well, I wonder, because I mean, according to Wikipedia, the first sort of one of the defining films is The Asphalt Jungle.
Yeah. I love that. John Huston. Fantastic John Huston film. Nice. Marilyn Monroe's first film as well, actually.
Yes, in a supporting role, yes. But then you could see elements in one of the really early films, The Great Train Robbery of 1903.
Yeah.
And also Criss Cross 1949, or The Killers 1946. So maybe, but I think, according to sort of, I think lots of people, The Asphalt Jungle is the first, sort of kicked off in the 50s. I guess it's one of those sort of maybe later genres like animal attack films, which really kicked off with the birds in the very early 60s.
Kind of a post-war thing, I think, after everyone came back from the
front.
From the big mess there, then there was that period when we got into film noir movies, and that was where, you know, and there's some really great examples. There's Stanley Kubrick's The Killing is a really good one.
Yes,
and there's just loads of really great heist movies. Rififi is a real classic French film, you know, absolute masterpiece, and lots of great heist films. But we thought tonight we didn't want to just talk about the obvious things because we're Film Swap, and that's where we're trying to dig a little bit deeper. And I think we've picked a couple of really interesting films tonight that fall within the heist category, but I think they're a little bit different.
They are very much. The first one, your choice, I hadn't even heard of before. But I really, really enjoyed it. Absolutely terrific film.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for recommending that. And my film, I would say, is sort of an unconventional heist film. It is a heist film, but it's definitely, you know, one of the ones that's sort of playing with the genre, you could say.
Indeed it is. Before we get into introducing our films tonight, what would you say are the key elements of a heist film? What makes a heist film?
Well, from my research, I found six particular elements. The first bit is basically about the planning, execution, and aftermath of a sort of crime, a theft normally. Mm. And some of them, when they play with the genre, some focus just on the planning and execution. Some it's just the sort of aftermath, like something like Reservoir Dogs. It's all aftermath, There's no planning or execution at all. And I guess they often have smaller crimes leading up to a bigger crime. And they almost always focus on the criminals themselves, and we learn to sort of sympathize with the criminals or the perpetrators of the crime. And one of the things that happens is that they assemble a team. They all members of the team have different skills, which is quite enjoyable. Then I guess that the other thing is that there's a sort of often failures due to fate or the sort of traits of the criminals themselves. The sort of personalities sort of make them slip up, and there's sometimes betrayals and injuries and things like that. So these are the something gets in the way, fate crops up and messes things up. So I think those are the qualities there, basically.
And what makes them so exciting, I guess, is just the fact, the idea of the planning, the meticulous planning, and the idea about whether something's going to go wrong. And usually the task seems quite impossible.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and there's always that element too. You say that it always focuses on the perpetrators of the crimes. Yeah. So you always have lots of interesting dynamics between the characters, and you can have different sort of characters, that play off each other.
Yeah.
And I think an appeal of them too is always there's a little bit of a sticking it to the man element of heist movies as well, isn't it? Because it's always kind of like the underdog who's trying to break into a really high secured bank or some sort of a complex. Or so there is like a little bit of a almost like a counterculture element to it, isn't there, of sort of rebellion and things that are part of it as well.
Yeah, well, I guess that's that sort of post-war quality is that it's sort of all these sort of slightly disillusioned soldiers, maybe.
Trying to find a way to get ahead in in a highly competitive sort of capitalist society where it's everything's kind of stacked against you. It's that idea that you can find some really clever plan to get around the system, kind of beat the system and come out on top somehow.
I wonder if, because we're sympathizing with criminals who are normally not meant to, I wonder if it's partly that many of these sort of writers had experience of war and sort of actors, that they had a sort of certain sympathy with the enemy who were going through this awful stuff as well. So there was a sort of natural, that sympathetic quality was translated into their movies.
Yeah, those are all really good points. And I think obviously listeners as well, we'd love to hear from you if you have any comments or things that you think make a great heist movie or some of the elements that make them so popular. I mean, there's even just really recent examples of really good heist movies like that Soderbergh film, The Logan Lucky. Which is pretty fun film to watch, and there's lots of films like that. I think a good heist movie is just always a good source of entertainment.
Yes, they're entertaining. I guess there's a sort of humor is often a quality in them.
Yeah.
And one of the things that made me watching these, especially the second one, is how sort of intense they are.
Yes, they can be, yes.
I mean, they're sort of one of the most intense genres of films, I would say.
Yeah, a lot of nail biting and edge of your seat, sort of, you know, what's going to go wrong? And, oh, they come this close to getting caught. And, oh, something goes wrong or somebody drops that screw or somebody... get seen by the wrong person at the wrong time, gets recognized, and you know, there's always just these elements of tension, and any minute the whole thing's going to go haywire, and that's I think what makes them really exciting, great pieces of entertainment. And I mean, again, like I said, there's so many great heist films that we could have chosen from. And we actually bounced a few ideas off of each other before we decided on the ones that we wanted to talk about tonight. Yeah. Obviously here at Film Swap, as I said, we're here to try and encourage people to dig deep and maybe check out some things that are a little bit more off the radar. So we chose our films tonight because for that reason, because they're very, very excellent films.
Yeah.
Of very high quality, but they might be ones that are not particularly mainstream and well known. although to be fair, I think the second film that we're going to talk about was relatively popular film when it came out. It was quite successful, and I think it won an Oscar. Did you want to just maybe talk very brief, just give a really, really high level introduction to the second film that we're going to be talking about tonight, and then we'll just go into the first film?
Yeah. The second film, my choice is Man on Wire, which is actually a documentary. Yeah. And it's basically telling the story of Philippe Petit, who's a French high wire artist, or sort of tightrope walker, basically. Mm-hmm. And he did this extraordinary thing that, I mean, I saw the film when it came out in 2008, and he basically walked between the Twin Towers in 1974 when they were sort of finishing off being built. They were sort of mostly complete, but not they were sort of 95% done. And it's just the most extraordinary feat, but the film itself is just absolutely terrific.
It's an extraordinary story, and it's incredibly well told. And even though it's a documentary film, it is got all the suspense and all the things that of a really great heist film.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
So we'll talk about that one in the second half of the show. And I'm really looking forward to having a conversation about it. And it was really great fun revisiting it as well.
Yeah.
But first up, we are going to be talking about a Hammer film.
Yes.
Of course, when I say that, some people might immediately start thinking of Dracula and Frankenstein and stakes going through the heart and monsters and ghouls and, creepy gothic castles and things like that.
Yeah.
But no, this is a really, really excellent, very small-scale crime film starring Peter Cushing, who is, of course, most well-known for his work in the Hammer horror films.
And Star Wars.
And Star Wars, yes, of course.
Younger listeners or viewers.
What's interesting is that a huge portion of the films that he made were for Hammer, for Hammer Productions. Obviously must have, either been quite good mates with them or had a contractual sort of arrangement with them, but he's in a lot of Hammer films.
Yeah.
And this film is actually was based on a television play. And this is obviously back in the days before people had VCRs and home video and things like that. So Hammer actually had they very often adapted television properties and made kind of big screen film versions of them for the cinemas. And this was a case where they took a television play called The Gold Inside that was made for a program called the Associated Television Theater 70.
That's catchy.
A bit of a mouthful. but apparently this was originally on television. And then Hammer made this really great film. It's called Cash on Demand. It was directed by a man named Quentin Lawrence.
Yep.
And aside from Peter Cushing, it stars the great Andre Morel as well as the dastardly villain of the piece.
And,
the two of them, this film is really kind of a masterclass in acting here. I think the entire cast, not just the two main characters, but the whole cast are absolutely spot on the money and just really sell this incredible little story. So the film came out in 1961. Interestingly enough, it was this was at a time when Hammer had a distribution arrangement with Columbia Pictures in America. Yeah. And what's interesting is that this film was made, but it didn't actually come out in the UK for over 2 years after it came out in America.
And, really?
Wow. Yeah. And so it actually ended up being shown in America first. And then when it was eventually shown in Britain, it was shown as the second half of like a double bill. And they actually cut about sort of 20 minutes off the running time.
Right.
In order to fit it in, presumably the reason they cut it was to fit it into like a double bill or something, so it wasn't too long. So the actual British version of the film is only about sort of 67 minutes. So
I watched the longer one.
Yeah. I mean, it is preferable to see the longer one, because what I did this time was because I watched it fairly recently, actually. I think just before Christmas. We're recording this in April of 24.
Yeah.
And I watched this film just sort of maybe sort of November of last year. So I felt it was still sort of fairly fresh in my mind. So I actually this time said, well, I'm going to check out the UK
part
of the film, because I just wanted to see what the differences were.
Definitely.
And what they primarily are is all just character-driven stuff at the beginning, like all the stuff at the beginning when Peter Cushing, who plays a bank manager, comes into the bank, and they kind of show what his character's like and how he relates to his staff and some of the sort of dynamics there within the work environment in this bank. And I think a lot of that stuff seems to be what they jettisoned when they cut the film down for UK distribution.
Okay, so it's pure crime in the UK one. No sort of...
Absolutely. It kind of just cuts to the chase.
Right.
And the main plot, I guess, that I'll share with the audience is that basically Peter Cushing is a bank manager. He's very stiff and uptight and quite draconian in his management method, shall we say. He's very sort of, he's not particularly friendly with the staff, and he's very, you know, sort of nitpicky and sort of demanding and not particularly friendly. And they kind of establish this early on. But then one day, this character, who's played by Andre Morel, comes in. At first, he presents himself as a... like someone from the bank's insurance company who's just come to do an audit on their security measures. Mm. But then once he gets Peter Cushing alone in his office, he sits down with him and he just basically says, look, we've got your wife and child, and if you don't do what I say, we're going to kill them.
No.
And on that basis, he basically gets this very stiff, uptight bank manager to effectively assist him in robbing the bank.
Yeah.
And that is the basic plot of the story.
Yeah. It's a terrific film. And yeah, the two central performances, Peter Cushing and Andre Morel, you know, are just great. They're really great actors and they do great performances here. But all the supporting actors, you know, I mean, I'd seen lots of their faces before and British TV and maybe films before. Mm. And but they, you know, they're just good quality actors. And the sort of paints a picture of a little small society, this sort of small workplace that's sort of just very believable. And sort of in some ways it's quite sort of Victorian because Mr. Fordyce, the Peter Cushing character, the bank manager, he wears galoshes and has a fob watch and has a great big leather-bound ledger. And which seems quite old-fashioned, but in some ways there's sort of the relationships between them all are very recognisable as well. And sort of, in some ways, it's sort of a bit quite modern. it's and it's got some really good dialogue in it as well, actually. One of the young characters, sort of young guys, trying to sort of chat up one of the younger woman, and an elderly woman sort of says to him, says to her, he wants to know if you're a hep cat or a square.
Yes.
Terrific. Yes. But there's a lot of good lines, actually.
Yes. I like the post of it when he's having a go at the guy about the dirty pen, basically.
Yes. And he goes,
this isn't the post office. This is a bank. You know, there's lots of brilliant little moments like that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, the bank is obviously, this isn't some big, huge corporate bank in a big city or whatever. This is just like back in the days of smaller kind of independent banks that are kind of more part of the local community. So it's just a small bank with a small staff. They obviously have all been working there for years and know each other very well, in the sense, you know, that they've spent a lot of time together, not that they're necessarily, you know, have sort of deep-rooted friendships or anything.
But having said that, there is that very night, they are having the office party because it's just before Christmas. So yes. They're all going off to the office party, except Fordyce, who's sort of basically a sort of bit of a
pooper. He's very bar humbug.
Well, that's the funny thing. When I was watching it, I was thinking, he's like Scrooge, essentially.
He is. I mean, you could actually argue, because it never occurred to me before, but this morning when I was rewatching the film, I kind of thought, actually, this is kind of like the Christmas Carol, isn't it? We have a character, and this is kind of a Christmas movie. Certainly, if you apply the Die Hard principle, if a film is set at Christmas time, it automatically makes it a Christmas film. So just on that basis, this is a Christmas film because it's set at Christmas time. Everybody's playing in a big Christmas party. And then we have Peter Cushing, who's, you know, office parties. I can't be bothered with all that frivolous nonsense.
Yeah.
and then through the course of the film and the obviously highly stressful and emotional events that he goes through the course of the film, he actually finds his change of heart and he begins to look at his staff in a different way.
Exactly. Well, the funny, because I wrote down at one stage, actually in my notes, Fordyce equals Scrooge. But the whole thing has a slightly Victorian sort of Dickensian feel to it. You know, like, as you said, with these nibs. I mean, you know, probably a few years later, everybody had biros. There were no nibs being used in banks. And by the sort of mid-60s, this is made in 1961, and, you know, all the fob watch and the leather ledger, you know, those are just very Victorian.
I love that little bit when he has a go at the lady because she's got Christmas cards that she's received from presumably staff and friends, and she's displaying them on her desk. And he comes over and he says, do we really need this vulgar display of your popularity? And he insists that she take them all away.
Yeah.
It's very, very amusing. But
it's really funny. And the funny thing, did you watch the discussion of the film on the DVD?
I didn't today, but I have done.
Because one of the things, one of the characters, because I watched half of it, and one of the sort of scholars or whoever it is says it's basically like a Christmas Carol. So,
there you go.
Yeah, wasn't just us thinking that. Exactly. Yeah, you know, it's really terrific. And I like the way that it keeps you sort of guessing as well, which is one of the things about a good sort of heist film, and sort of shifting sympathies. You know, do I like the Colonel Gore Hepburn, the sort of the baddie, or not? And Harry Fordyce and all these people, you sort of slightly also wonder whether the staff are in on it at some stage, or perhaps the star.
Or whether that it's all just a hoax because he keeps going to the window and making signals and saying, I got a man outside and I'm doing signals. But you kind of think, is there actually anyone out there, or is that just a way that he's using to manipulate Peter Cushing's character?
Exactly.
And he's quite something too, Andre Moreau, because he has this real sense of sort of, he's kind of charming and quite sort of, you know, has a lot of charisma, and he comes in, but at the same time, he has this incredible undercurrent of kind of viciousness that you can see in him.
Yeah.
And you just always like, it's like he seems like he's almost like this coiled spring, and at any moment,
yeah,
do something really nasty, and you just really get that feeling from him. So he pitches it just absolutely perfect, because he kind of comes in and he sort of has this, he makes some really funny quips and some good observations, and he's quite almost this charismatic character, but you can see just bubbling underneath that sort of like, this guy, you know, he could do something nasty, and you can see it.
Yeah, well, when you say that he's charming, one of the great lines in the film. He says, "I want bank robberies to be smoother, more sociable."
it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
And he has a great sort of voice as well, doesn't he? Which is very
indeed. Yeah, I mean, these guys are all, you know, sort of quite clearly brought up on the stage, aren't they? And they have like just terrific sort of nuances and things. I mean, Peter Cushing as well is just brilliant, because he's a very, especially at the beginning anyway, he's quite unsympathetic.
Yes,
he kind of comes across as this really harsh authoritarian sort of figure. But then when the kind of the tables are turned, where he suddenly, from becoming the boss and the sort of the senior figure, when everyone is quite deference, has a lot of deference to him.
Yeah.
There's quite all that sycophancy and things that you see in kind of these kind of work environments.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden he's faced with someone who's, you know, hypothetically more senior than him. And that sort of the whole dynamic for him changes, and has the tension progresses, and all the nervous energy and stuff, you can see all that facade of his crumble as the story goes on.
Yes.
And he was such a great actor, Peter Cushing, actually.
He was. Yeah. One thing that I was going to mention about Peter Cushing is that I remember when I was little, Jim Will Fix It, which was massive when I was sort of young, with Jimmy Savile. Unfortunately, you know, horrible person. But anyway, Peter Cushing was once a guest on it.
Right.
And the Fix It that happened was that they had a rose named after Peter Cushing's wife.
Oh.
And I think maybe his wife had just died, or maybe she was still alive. But anyway, I just thought, that's actually one of the few, about the only thing I really remember of it is Peter Cushing's rose. And it was, really just a very sweet moment. And he was there on it, and he just came across as a very lovely, humble, rose loving chap. Which, I think, extraordinary guy, I guess.
I remember there was a story I'd heard quite recently. I don't know if it was in an interview or where I was reading it or something, but it was recently I heard a story about Christopher Lee, and he was doing a movie with Peter Cushing, and this was just shortly after his wife had passed away.
Okay.
And he obviously was still kind of going through the grieving process.
Right.
But he had agreed to do of this film, and he showed up on the set, and then he was kind of quite nervous and sort of like going, oh no, I don't think I could do it.
Right.
And then Christopher Lee took him aside and started reminiscing with him and talking with him about the old days working and all these old films and stage things and that. And he managed to make him relaxed enough that he could come and do the work and shoot the scenes that they needed to do.
Right.
And I don't know why that just, that your Rose story just reminded me of that too, that it just really shows it how he seemed, he was quite a sensitive soul and quite a, you know, a kind of a gentle, nice man.
Yeah.
Even though he's quite, was quite famous for making a lot of horror films and monster movies and things like that.
Yeah. So, well, it says, actually, it says on his wiki page that, yeah, when his wife died, he was sort of, he was so crushed that when his first autobiography was published, he couldn't even talk about it. He said, "I can't." He said, "The heart quite simply has gone out of everything," and yeah, he was utterly sort of devastated. Yeah, gosh, but. Yeah, and another thought that occurred to me in this film is that another sort of anecdote that I'd heard was about John Lennon, because as you mentioned earlier, it's like a small sort of like small town bank. So it reminded me a little bit about of It's a Wonderful Life, the sort of small town sort of type environment. And old-fashioned. Anyway, this story is of John Lennon in the sort of late 60s when the Beatles sort of business was sort of in trouble. And apparently him and his mates stayed up all night sort of tripping on acid. And as they came down and they saw, yes, what we need to do is get the bank manager from Guildford Bank, or one of the banks in Guildford, which, you know, small town in Surrey, sort of bit like the town in this one, and he can take over the running of the Beatles. And I just anyway, eventually this guy Alan Klein took over, who was a sort of shark essentially, and very much the opposite of a small town bank manager. But that sort of that idea of the a small town bank manager being the sort of the pillar of local society and the sort of impeccably honest. Somebody who just couldn't sort of do anything dishonest, even if he wanted to, as that being the sort of the generally held belief back then.
There's even a line he says near the beginning when he's having a go at someone, and he kind of says, he makes this something that I think today people would strain to sympathize with this sentiment, but he kind of said, you know, banking is one of the last dignified professions, and, you know, and he makes this statement, and it is, but you can see in those days and in that kind of environment where it was a small community-based bank,
yeah,
that were very central to the community. They knew their customers, they yeah. knew the local businesses, and they were part of that community, and there was a lot of trust.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, importance that in that providing those services.
Definitely.
Whereas today, where everything's all merged into these big, huge kind of, you know, thieving monsters, basically, that we have today, this is kind of a completely culturally different representation of banking and stuff, isn't it? So
completely different.
It's quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's and it's got some nice sort of understated English humour, you might say, or British humour. And it finishes off with, "I'm afraid I can't wish you good luck," when the guy sort of leaves. yes. Yeah, it really terrific film. And
what did you make of the actual heist and the plan itself, and the, you know, the sort of, because we've talked a lot about the humour and the characters and things, but we haven't actually really touched on the actual crime itself and the plan and stuff. So in terms of someone who's looking for a suspenseful heist movie,
I think
what would you tell them that this has to offer?
Yeah, it's sort of plausible. It's what, as I said earlier, it sort of keeps you guessing because you're not sure. I guess I got a little bit confused about it. As you say, you know, is there really somebody outside or not? It's not giving too much away. Early on, he picks up the phone and his wife is sort of screaming. So, and you sort of wonder, is that really what, you know, the case? And then when the guy goes, you sort of wonder, is he going to get away with it, even though he's fled? And yeah, I thought it was, it worked pretty much. And always with heists, there's a sort of, one of the main tensions is the plan and then chance. What's going to happen to the plan? Because he's all, this film, you know, lots of heist films, you see a lot of the planning, or some of them. But this one, you don't see the planning, but you know there has been a lot of planning. Mm. It becomes clear as soon as the crime starts taking place, you realize that this guy
is... Yeah, like he knows even everything about all the employees at the bank. He knows all about their background and how long they've been working there and what they do for hobbies and everything. Yeah. So he's clearly done incredible amounts of research and worked out. I was quite interested by the very quaint security in the bank by today's standards, like the things like the little electric eye was just literally like a single electric eye. And I immediately conjured up in my mind, you remember, I can't remember what it's called, but there was that film with Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones where she had to slither through all the... I can't remember what that film's called. It's not particularly memorable except for that moment, of course, Catherine Zeta-Jones. Slithering through these red lights. So that kind of brought that to mind, the fact that they just have this single electric eye that they just flip a switch that's just like right beside it. So it's hardly like a really robust sort of security feature, really.
Exactly. Well, I guess one of the classics like that is Mission Impossible, where they've got all these sort of ridiculous sort of security precautions which they're thwarting all the time.
Like the things like it registers body heat or, you know, other sort of things like you get in Mission Impossible, and then this thing is literally just like a light and there's a switch beside it and he just goes, oh, turn off the electric eye, click, and it's off. And it's sort of like, yeah, I mean, that's not really a particularly foolproof security measure, is it?
And
then the things like if the door isn't shut properly, a light starts to go off and something, and there's all this suspense built around this moment when he forgets to shut the inner door, and if the thing doesn't get switched off after 30 seconds, an automatic alarm goes down to the police or whatever it is. So there's this frantic, you know, you didn't shut the door properly. And then, you know, and it's like sort of stuff like this. But I say it's quaint, and it is, but it's actually also very effective and very entertaining. Like the film works on that level because there is lots of little moments. Because the key thing is that Peter Cushing's character is this very straight-laced, very prim and proper and by the book person is suddenly thrust into this situation where he's pulling off a bank job in his own bank, and he's concerned about getting caught, because if he gets caught, his wife and child are potentially going to be murdered. So there, the suspense element is there, but it's just all pared down into this very small kind of claustrophobic environment rather than this big huge spectacle and this big giant elaborate heist in a big huge complex with soldiers and all this kind of stuff. It's literally just a couple of guys in small rooms, you know, coming into these, you know, sort of, you know, very tense filled things, and one of the guys is completely totally out of his element, and he's just been thrown into it suddenly at the last minute. He suddenly finds himself in this highly charged, tense sort of situation. So
I guess that sort of, it doesn't go too far from the original television play, which of course we don't know what it was, but what it was like. But the sort of television plays are generally in a room, essentially.
Yes. Which is certainly in those days when they were live and they were just basically stage plays with cameras there to record them. Yeah.
I mean, this is mostly sort of the front of the bank, his office, and then downstairs in the sort of whatever it is.
Down in the vault.
In the vault, that's it. Yeah. And there's basically sort of three rooms and maybe outside briefly. Yeah. But yeah, it still takes that. But that's what makes it sort of intense. It's the sort of claustrophobia. And I think claustrophobia is one of the sort of important qualities of a heist movie as well, isn't it? And this one really has it in spades because of the sort of, well, the sort of limitations of it, because it's a pretty cheap film. They made it for, well, £37,000, which I think even then was sort of relatively cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's not a lot of money, even by the standards of the early 60s. That's quite an inexpensive film.
Definitely.
They manage again, just, I mean, it's a highly, highly effective little film.
Yeah.
And really enjoyable. So, Jonathan, is there anything else that you would like to say about Cash on Demand? If you were faced with a real naysayer who was like, hey, Jonathan, why would I want to watch that movie? Oh, my goodness. What would you say to them?
Well, I'd say, firstly, it's short, so you're not going to take, it's not going to take too much of your time. Secondly, it's got the great Peter Cushing. And, you know, but also Andre Morel, who it turns out I'd never heard of him before, but he's actually quite a fairly big name in sort of 40s.
At that time, in the 50s and sort of early 60s, he was a regular fixture in British film and television. And I think he was in the one of the Quatermass movies as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he was in Barry Lyndon.
Barry Lyndon, yeah, well, yeah, that must have been towards the end. But
yeah, he was in a number of Bridge on the River Kwai, Ben Hur, and Barry Lyndon. So he was in some sort of, you know, big films, but I guess he wasn't sort of, didn't have big roles in those. But he's a terrific actor. So got great performances, very, you know, really good script, a very clever script, but, you know, these great lines as well. And yeah, it's just, there's very little problems with it. I think it's just all great all around. Terrific. Mm. And it's funny that I was watching it thinking, wait a second, this is an absolutely brilliant film. Why the hell have I not even heard of it before? Not that I've not seen it, I've heard of it.
Well, it is, even for me, like, it was a relatively recent discovery. I actually, it came as part of a box set. There's a company called Indicator, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that they publish nice editions of films, and they did a series of box sets collecting all of the Columbia Hammer films. And it's in one of the sets this film came in. Those sets are out of print now, but the films are available individually. I'll just show this now while we're talking about it. I usually save this till the end of the show, but it's called Cash on Demand.
Yeah.
It's available from Powerhouse Films, their Indicator label. So it's available separately now. And I only discovered it myself last year. As I said, it was part of this set. And I was working my way through watching them, and I got to this one, and I was totally like, this is just a great film. I mean, a lot of the films in those sets and around that period for Hammer, they're all kind of spot on. They're excellent little films.
Right. Just
like a whole bunch of them like this. But this one in particular really struck me because it was just so clever, so simple, straightforward, small, but absolutely just, you know, riveting and really interesting and entertaining piece of film.
Yeah.
And like you say, it's nice and short. It's not like a huge commitment of time or anything. It just gets in there, gets right to it, and just sucks you in, tells you this really clever little story, and then and then off you go for a bite to eat. So it's just a terrific film. I think it's one of those films at the time, it just, for whatever various reasons, like I said, it was released in America pretty much straight away. But, you know, back then they used to just bury things on the second half of double bills and things. And I think it's just one of those films that just kind of came and went and didn't really sort of catch anybody's attention. And so it's a little bit more obscure.
Yeah.
But that's why we're here tonight, shouting it out to the rafters, that if you want a really cool, good heist film, yeah, you definitely want to look this one out. It's available on Blu-ray from Indicator, and I actually have no idea about the streaming situation, whether it's available. I didn't look. Hopefully it is available on streaming somewhere, but definitely, folks, go and make the effort and go and try and find it, because it's terrific. Well, one other thing people in America could check out, because I think Mill Creek have a little set of all the Columbia Hammer films in a kind of little budget set, where they've got sort of like two or three movies to a disc, and it's fairly cheaply priced, and it's got like about 20 movies in it or something. Wow. And I'm pretty sure Cash in Demand would be one of the titles in that set. So that's quite a good value item to pick up, because, like I said, it's got loads of films and it's pretty cheap. So there's loads and loads of good stuff on there to watch. Go and find that, folks. If it isn't available on streaming, you can go and look that out, because that's quite worth picking up.
Yeah.
Right. So on that note, Jonathan, I think what we might do is take a little break and maybe go and cool off and get over all the tension of that bank job. And then we're going to talk about a very, very different type of heist film. So folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back in just mere seconds from the listener's point of view. And we'll be back to talk about James Marsh's classic documentary, Man on Wire.
Yes.
So we'll be right back.
What a film. Thanks for listening to the Film Swap podcast. If you like this podcast, please consider giving the show a rating or leaving a review. This helps other listeners find the show. You can follow the Film Swap on social media. We're on Twitter and TikTok at Film Swap UK, on Instagram at Film Swap Media, and on YouTube at Film Swap _podcast, and at Facebook at Film Swap The Podcast.
And we're back. Welcome back, listeners, and welcome back, Jono. We're here for the second half of our heist double bill tonight, and after all the tension and suspense of the first half, I think you're going to find that we're going to be taking it to new levels in the second half, aren't we? To new heights.
To new heights.
That was our second film. Jonathan, I'm going to hand it over to you, because this was your pick tonight for the film. So I'm going to hand it over to you to introduce the 2008 documentary called Man on a Wire. You know what? I keep mixing that up, because there is a film called Man on a Wire, isn't there? Bird on a Wire, isn't there?
Well, there's a...
Goldie Hawn, Mel Gibson.
Oh, is that? All right.
Am I right? Is that right? Or am I just like... Is that just a complete figment of my imagination?
I would make sense.
I could be getting to that stage where I'm starting to literally just like hallucinate films.
Yeah, there is. John Badham directed it.
There you go. Okay, so it does exist.
Yeah, with Mel Gibson, you're right, and Goldie Hawn.
Yes, yes. So that's why I keep thinking Man on a Wire, but it's actually just called Man on Wire.
Man on Wire, yeah. And it's directed by the British film director, James Marsh. And he won a... Oscar for it. In fact, the film was one of the few, one of only six documentaries ever to win the Big Four, which are the LA Film Festival, the New York Film Festival, the National Board of Review of Motion Pictures, and the National Society of Film Critics. Mm. It also won a BAFTA. Basically, it won everything in terms of documentaries that year.
I think there is a general consensus amongst people who have seen this film.
Yeah.
That it is a really cracking good film.
Mm.
Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it must be, because I remember watching it when it came out thinking, this is one of the most amazing films I've ever seen. And then when I watched it earlier in the week, I wasn't disappointed. I thought, this is still an absolutely brilliant film. Like Philippe Petit himself, it doesn't put a foot wrong. Basically,
I love it. It absolutely does not. It's riveting. And you know what? This time, I mean, I've seen it a couple times previously. I saw it kind of when it came out.
Yeah.
And then I watched it, I think, a few years ago. I rewatched it. And then earlier this week, I sat down and I watched it with my 12-year-old son.
Oh, really?
I said, I'm going to watch this movie because we're talking about it on the show.
Yeah.
Would you like to come and sit and watch it with me? I think you might enjoy it.
Yeah.
And he was like, sort of like, all right then. He sat down with me and he was absolutely riveted 10 minutes in. And he was absolutely like this for the whole film. And afterwards, he was already quite excited about it.
Yeah.
And he absolutely loved it. This is a really, really great film. And the key thing is because not only is it like a really, really interesting, just extraordinary story.
It's an unbelievable story. Still, I can't get my head around the fact this actually happened.
Yes, it's extraordinary. And then to top it all off, the film itself is done it's an excellent telling of the story. It's done in a way like a heist film, because it is a heist film.
Yeah.
It is, they are planning and committing a criminal act.
Exactly.
But it's different in the sense that they're not stealing money or hurting anyone or doing anything. They're just doing this incredibly, extraordinarily daft, but also quite extraordinarily beautiful, really.
Very beautiful.
Sort of, you know, act of, I don't know, what would you even call it? Just like this kind of like
performance art. It's,
I guess so, yes. The
interesting thing is that this film is I'm sure the reason I chose it, because I'm sure when it came out, I remember reading an interview with James Marsh, the director, and he said, we tried to structure it like a heist movie.
Hmm.
And it uses lots of the sort of tropes and the, you know, motifs you get in heist movies, which we'll talk about in a bit. And it's an art heist, but unlike most heists where they're stealing something, in this film, not only is it's the two main sort of, you know, inversions of the sort of genre, the sort of turning it upside down, is one that it's a documentary rather than fiction, and the other thing is that rather than stealing something, he's giving something, because he's giving this extraordinary statement, this work of art, this sort of, I don't know what it is. It's something that one of the amazing things about it is that in the telling of it, so he's got all these talking heads like a normal documentary, and one of his friends talks about it, and especially towards the end of the film, he just can't stop breaking down in tears, because it's just the intensity of heist films, of this event. It's just sort of just, he still can't wrap his head around it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, and it's an extremely moving film, and it's good on so many levels. And you know, and James Marsh, he went on to win an Oscar for A Theory of Everything, which was all right. But this film, I just think, is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And actually, the first film before I came to, I think I went to see this film because in sort of 6 or 7 years before, I'd been watching some reruns of Arena documentaries, which is a sort of BBC documentary series, in the sort of 2000, 2001, something like that. And they showed one of his films from the 97 called The Burger and the King, which is really, really good. Also about Elvis Presley and his diet, which I highly recommend. It's only an hour long.
Yeah, no, I've seen that one as well, actually, yeah.
Yeah, is and that I think when because I knew because I heard the name, I thought, oh, this it's not going to be a bad film if I because I really like The Burglar and the King. Anyway, it's and I went along, and one of the interesting things, not only did I think this film's brilliant, but I saw it in the I remember where I saw it, the Curzon Soho, and in the foyer, or they had the book, and I bought it. That it's based on, and not only did it have the was it just a copy of the book, but it's actually signed by Philippe Petit himself, and I'll show you the signature. There it is. Look at that. Ah. Can you see that?
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah,
he wasn't actually there at the time. It was sort of pre-signed.
It was pre-signed. It wouldn't surprise me if he'd been in. But
well, he must have been. That's probably where it came from. Maybe when they had a screening of the film, he was there at the premiere or something.
Exactly. That's what that's the feeling I got. Yeah. And so it all felt a bit more sort of present then.
What do you make of the act itself? Because the idea,
yeah.
I mean, tightrope walking in and of itself, it's quite a, you know, it's not something I could do because I'm not particularly great with heights.
No.
And the thing is, this guy, like, talk about extreme yeah. high wire walking, tightrope walking. I mean, this was something where quite literally it was almost kind of like suicidal in yeah. scope, wasn't it?
It was
like, this was something that quite easily on so many levels could have gone wrong.
Yeah.
So quickly, so fast, so easily.
Yeah.
At any moment, this all could have went really badly.
Well, one of the things about the film is that it takes from the genre of heist is that a lot of it's about planning.
Yeah.
And also it has these smaller crimes leading up to the bigger crimes. So the smaller crimes, first he does it on the... Notre Dame in Paris, the cathedral.
Yeah.
And then
this wasn't his first time doing these stunts, no. Is it? He did it once in, was it Australia?
He did it on
some sort of suspension bridge or something.
Yeah. And then he did it in
Notre Dame
yeah.
Cathedral.
Notre Dame, for our American listeners.
Yes, Notre Dame. Yes. in doing these big, you know, stunts.
Yeah.
And he's kind of, you remember, it's like that guy, I don't know, you don't hear much of him anymore, but there was that guy at one point, he had himself hung in a big plastic box and said he wasn't
David Blaine
for 30 days. What was his name?
David Blaine.
Yeah, okay. And he did a few. There was this guy who was going around doing these kind of ridiculous stunts, wasn't he? Like, yeah. And they were sort of, I don't know if they were tricks or what was going on.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But this is in that same vein, isn't it? Where this is a guy who picks these, he's a tightrope walker, but he picks these extraordinary sites to do it on.
Yeah.
And he kind of sneaks in there and does it. Without, you know, it hasn't been prearranged with any authorities. So yeah. They're kind of acts in a way of defiance, aren't they? Yeah. In the sense yeah. that there's an element of being naughty about it because,
yeah.
you know, there is an element of like put it endangering people as well, because if one of these things goes wrong, there's the potential that not only the chap himself, Philippe, who's doing the tightrope walking, but other people could get hurt as well, right? Or things yes. could get damaged or...
Yeah, I mean, most of the damage is going to be to him, really, I think.
Well, yeah. Well, he would die, yeah.
He would die.
No question. That's what I mean, like, especially in the case of this where... So the idea is that basically they snuck into the World Trade Center
yeah.
when it was just freshly minted, and they snuck all their gear up,
yeah.
strung a tight wire between the two buildings, which in and of itself was quite an extraordinary feat just even accomplishing that
yeah.
in and of itself is extraordinary. And then this chap literally walked along the wire between the two buildings.
Yeah.
And like, this is up, like, how high are these buildings? They're like sort of, at the time, they were like amongst the highest buildings in the world, weren't they?
Yeah, well, yeah. And there's, the way he describes it is, there was one moment when my foot left the building and I was on the wire. Sort of just the sort of thought of it was slightly enough to make your stomach turn.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, in that one heartbeat, that one, the minute his foot left the building and went onto that wire, that could have been the end of him right there.
It would have been
all over right there, because a gust of wind, or he just got this balance slightly off, anything.
Yeah.
And that was it. It was a done deal.
But like the best heist sort of criminals, they had done an enormous amount of preparation. They built sort of architects' models on desks and sort of strung out the wires and everything, and then built and then had a field in Normandy where they'd sort of strung up the sort of replicas of the wires and had their friends sort of sort of jumping on it.
Just they tried to think of everything, but like any heist film, because a lot of the thing about heist films is quite often is the suspense about thinking, like, where is it going to go wrong? Where is that one thing that they missed?
Exactly.
Or the one thing that happens out of the, you know, that they weren't expecting, you know, that, and that's kind of what creates that tension in that.
Yes.
And, but this was a real story, like a true story.
Yeah.
And quite a, you know, so it really adds to that sort of gripping. I mean, obviously, because I've seen it a couple times now, the suspense is slightly diluted in the sense that I kind of know what's going to happen, but even still, it's still quite a riveting and story.
Well, one of the examples of where fate sort of rears its ugly head, or luckily nothing goes too far wrong, is when they're sort of up in this sort of empty sort of office space. Well, it's going to be office space. It's a sort of empty floor. And there's just security guards there. And suddenly the security guard turns up and they leap under a tarpaulin. And they find there's basically a sort of steel girder stretched over a 400-meter drop.
Sit
on this iron girder over this 400-meter drop for sort of 4 hours or something.
Yeah, waiting for this guy to go away.
Wait for the guy to go away.
And he's just kind of standing around. He's probably sort of hiding there, you know, having a fag and sort of not, you know, thinking and, you know, having a quiet sort of shifty break.
Yeah, basically, slacking off. It's just, that's probably the biggest the closest that you think, could gone wrong. But another great thing about, well, another sort of similar thing that makes it sort of heist-like is, of course, it's, you know, focusing on the criminals, but also assembling the team. So there's the French guys, the original sort of the core, and then when they're in Australia, they get the Australian, and so he joins them. And then when they go to New York, they pick up some American accomplices as well. They each have a different role, and the funny thing is, I guess the Americans are more because they're later come to it later. They don't have quite the sort of belief in the whole process as the original, the French and the Australian do, because they sort of start running away. I mean, in a way, like, that's what any sensible person would have.
Really. I mean, I must admit, I would be in that if I was approached to ask to, you know, help in something like this, I must admit, I would have been completely skeptical. I guess that's part of my nature, that I would have been like, dude, that's never going to work. You're just going to kill yourself. That's crazy. You're never going to get away with that.
Yeah.
Leave me out of it, kind of thing. That would be my reaction.
Yeah, well, I completely agree.
These guys were kind of like, you know, one of them, he was quite open about that he liked this cliff and everything.
Yeah.
And he was just sort of like, yeah, man, sounds like fun. Let's do it, kind of thing. And that's brilliant.
Yes. Well, that was actually one of the things I quite liked, that it had the sort of milieu, the that they it was all taking place in was this sort of very sort of hippie bohemian, to quote James Fox in Performance, it was a very bohemian atmosphere. And so I guess, but he was not a sort of a druggy hippie, was he, Philippe Petit? He was
no, not at all. Quite the opposite. He seemed like he was very fit, very focused, very resolute in his sort of we're doing this, and we're just going to find a way to make this happen.
Yeah,
maybe if you've read the book, I don't know if you.
I've read it. No, it's completely. So fresh.
I know. If I could, like, if I had a pound for every book or thing that I've bought with all the best intentions, and then they end up sitting on the shelf for years before I get around to them. but the one thing I was really unclear of, and they never talk about it in the film.
Yeah.
And even when I, was reading up after the fact.
Yeah.
One thing I really don't understand is, because they never talk about it, how was this little project financed? How did they pay for all this? All the jet setting between France and New York, all the equipment that they needed, the hotel rooms that they were staying in. How was this little adventure financed? Because they didn't talk about having any kind of sponsorship.
No,
I mean, is it that just Philippe was just sort of independently wealthy and could just afford to do these things on a whim, or
I don't know.
What is the story about? Where did they get the money to do this?
Yeah, I don't know about that. Actually, that's a very good point. I mean, I guess
presumably they'd want a meal every once in a while they were in New York and stuff.
That's true.
This would have had to have been paid for, right?
Yeah. Well, I got the feeling that they were sort of doing it as cheaply as possible. They sort of possibly sofa surfing in New York, but still, you would need some money because they did do quite a few trips to New York and back to France.
Yeah, they were going back and forth, and they were staying in hotels, which, Stan, you can find cheap hotels, but it adds up if you're doing it for weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of like, so I was never clear on that. I was sort of like, was somebody sponsoring this? Or was the guy was he wealthy or something? And he could just do this as like a hobby, like for something to do, to amuse himself. Like, I was never really clear on that.
That's true. Well, he
didn't make a lot of money, normally doing his performing and stuff, that he made enough money that he could afford to do something like this.
I don't know. I mean, you can earn pretty good money busking, I think.
Perhaps if there are any of our listeners out there have any insights on that question, we would be very happy to hear from you. If you could drop us a comment or send us a note or something on one of our social media things, and let us know if you have any insights into how this project was financed. I'd be interested to know about that. You talked a little bit about the relationship, because there was a key friendship. I mean, obviously he had a girlfriend.
Yes,
sort of. She seemed slightly more reluctantly involved in it.
Mm.
She was his girlfriend, so she sort of stood by him and she helped sort of on the peripheral, but she didn't necessarily get involved directly in the sort of actual acts of trespass.
Not that day, no, or that night, no.
But there's also, you talk about his friendship. Sorry, what was the chap's name, his main friend?
Francois was one of them.
Yeah.
There was two main French accomplices. One who was sort of very friendly looking, and the other one who was sort of, who had the sort of, this immense emotional sort of reaction to it.
Yeah, that's the one I mean, because I think you may, because you, if you consider, I don't know how far back their relationship went, but obviously their friendship was very intense in a sense, wasn't it? Because in order for this friend to go along with all this and to help him and support him and to help him organize it, and they obviously had spent a lot of time arguing back and forth about the best way to do things. So this man, even though he wasn't the one who actually went out on the wire, he was clearly highly invested in it in terms of doing it and making it happen.
Yeah,
he was. So I just thought that that brought an interesting sort of layer to the story as well, just the relationship. Because you, if you think about, you know, about how intense the planning and implementing of this would be, that the kind of relationship that these people had, the type of friendship must have been very kind of strong.
Yeah, well, Jean-Louis Blondeau is the one who is sort of basically has seemed like his right-hand man. He was the one that was sort of slightly tearful. And then the other one who, with the sort of friendly face, I would say, was Jean-François Heckel. And yeah, so those were the main French accomplices. And then there was...
And that's another thing. I mean, the film touches on a little bit that the kind of the relationships changed after the event. But the film doesn't really go into a lot about what Philippe kind of got up to after this. Because obviously this was such a huge monumental thing to do and such an experience.
Yeah.
But they don't really go into sort of like, because this film was made, it came out in 2008. So it was sort of like kind of 30 years after the events.
Yeah.
And now we're another nearly 20 years after that.
Yeah.
But we don't really like what became of Philippe after this, because what kind of a life did he lead after he did this extraordinary thing?
That is true. I think he did carry on doing walks. I mean, in some ways, he'd sort of, that's the strange thing about, like, with his relationship with his sort of best mate and his girlfriend both seemed to stop. It was like, it was, everything was just, it was just too intense. And and it all came to an end, which is rather sort of sad, I suppose. But there's some, great sort of dialogue in it. That was it. When he was walking on the wire, he said, "Death is very close," which I thought was really interesting. And the funny thing was that he was doing this walk with wearing flares.
Well, that would have been sort of commonplace at the time, I think.
It was commonplace, but it still made me chuckle because, I don't know, flares don't seem like the sort of thing you risk your life wearing. But anyway, I guess that's what they wore then. And that's what, absolutely made sense. and towards the end, when the police are basically... come along and said, "Look, you've got to get down." Because, amazingly, he is up there for 45 minutes. He does eight crossings. So each one's about sort of 5 minutes long.
Yeah, that's mental. And they said he kept teasing the police. He
would lying down right up
on the edge like he was going to come out. And then he would go, no, I'm going back. And what amazed me too was like how he didn't just walk on this wire, like he would lie down on his back.
Yeah.
And you would just look at him and you just think, like, how the hell do you get back up?
Yeah.
You know, because I'm still, and they never really show it either, which really bothered me as well, because I kept looking at him when he was lying there on his back on this wire and thinking, how the heck do you get up when you're on a wire in between the World Trade Center and you're lying on your back? How exactly do you get up
and
get back on your feet again to get off of there? And how easy would it be for that to go wrong?
Well, as he said, you know, death is very close. And I like the fact that he used the present tense, even though he's talking about it 30 years later. But he said that the police sort of said, "We're going to send a helicopter to sort of try and get you if you don't." And his friend said, "You better come down." But he did say,
But the helicopter was like a daft idea, because if you sent a helicopter in there, it would just knock him off.
Well, exactly.
How would they pick him up? Like how would that even work?
I guess that was just a threat. Get down or we're going to kill you.
Maybe.
But he did say that, and that probably saved my life, not in the fact that the helicopter would have killed me, but I would have just been wandering around until I'd fell off.
Yeah, it's true. The longer he was there, the more likely it was that at some point he was going to make a mistake and yeah. that would have been the end of him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. 45 minutes was long enough.
I totally don't remember the name of the chap who it was, and it was such a long time ago, but I was just a boy, but I have very vivid memory of, yeah. Of another, like a tightrope walker, much like him in the 70s.
I haven't heard about this.
Oh, no, and he fell off he was doing a stunt, not on this kind of scale,
right?
But similar, like he was walking between two buildings or on a bridge or some really, you know, dangerous thing, and he actually fell. And I have vivid memories. I don't remember the chap's name or anything, but I remember when, because, you know, back on the news, when things like that would happen, they keep showing the footage over and over again.
Right.
And I think we might have even been watching it live. Like, it was like, because at the time there was a lot of stuff like that, like Evel Knievel and things like that.
Yes.
The guy who did these crazy stunts.
I remember.
He drove a motorcycle over the Grand Canyon and
yeah,
sort of crazy things like this, and they used to televise them on TV. And then this chap who was doing this high wire act, and he actually fell and died. God. And I have very vivid memories of that as a child, seeing that on television.
Really?
And so that obviously kind of informed my emotional response to watching this film as well, because obviously in those moments when he's doing this, probably on some sort of primordial level, my brain was remembering being a little kid and seeing on TV this poor man falling to his death. And you know, so anyway.
Wow.
Again, I can't remember the name of the guy, and it would have been sometime in the sort of mid to late 70s. I would have been quite young.
Right.
It obviously made quite an impression on me seeing that as a child.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's terrific. It's within the sort of genre. So, you know, some of them focus before, some during, and some after, and some have a bit more. And this one, sort of pretty much afterwards, it sort of very quickly finishes. You know, you get sort of 5 or 10 minutes what happens afterwards, but you don't learn much more than that. You see it. What one interesting thing is, you see a picture of him on the roof of the World Trade Center with his written his signature on a sort of girder there, wearing a massive fur coat, looking very sort of 70s made it type guy.
Yeah, like a pop star, yeah.
Exactly.
Like, you know, Roger Daltrey or something, sort of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A lot of Bee Gees.
Just to me, it's an extraordinary story and very well told.
Yeah.
Just a really entertaining and gripping film. Couldn't recommend it highly enough for people if you've never seen it. You mentioned, because I didn't, somehow I must have just completely missed it when it came out, but apparently there is a fictionalized, like, drama film that was made by Robert Zemeckis, of all people, made a film. I don't know why I say that, like, why not Robert Zemeckis? Could, you know, he's a good, you know, he's a good,
never do think a thing like that.
Yes, I have no idea why I said that. Like, I don't know. I got nothing against Robert Zemeckis. I quite like several of his films, and he was a good filmmaker. So, but anyway, apparently he made a film based on this story as well.
Yes, I've seen it actually. And I mean, as far as I can remember, it was a while ago I saw it. So it came out in 2015. I guess it's in the last 9 years.
That's quite a while ago now.
But yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a good film. And I think I remember thinking, how can they make a film of such an incredible, you know, documentary? But I remember thinking, actually, this isn't bad. I mean, it's not quite on the level of the documentary, but it's pretty good.
I'll have to check it out. Just I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
I mean, I know sometimes I quite often, if I see a really, really good documentary and then someone makes an actual sort of dramatic film, I usually don't like them.
Yeah.
I know I'm always, what is it, Rescue Dawn, you know, the one that Werner Herzog did where he remade Little Dieter Loves to Fly to such a brilliant, amazing film. And then he made a sort of dramatic version of it with Christian
Bale.
And it's just dreadful. It's absolutely dreadful. In comparison, anyway, I guess. That's what I'm trying to say. So I kind of think it's the same thing. I would be worried if I see Man on Wire and then think that if somebody then went and made a sort of a drama film out of it, that it will pale in comparison. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that sort of I was worried about before, it had an American playing this Frenchman, and I thought, how's his accent going to be? It's surely, I mean, the whole thing, I'm just going to be thinking, no, that's just awful. But actually, I mean, well, it's difficult. It's difficult.
Is he good? Well, he is a really good, I rate that guy as an actor. I quite like him. He's been in a lot of really good films and stuff, and really? I quite like him. So.
Yeah, not bad. It didn't sort of, didn't grate at all. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I'll have to check it out at some point if it crops up in front of me at some point. So again, I'll ask you the question, John, and someone comes up to you and they say, why would I want to watch this documentary about some guy walking on a wire? What's all that about? What would you say to him?
Well, I'd say this is one documentary, even if you don't like documentaries, this is one documentary you should really watch, because the story itself is absolutely extraordinary, just unbelievable and mind-blowing. It's told very, very well. And one of the interesting things that I forgot to mention is that actually at the sort of the peak of the story, basically one of his accomplices, or a number of them, have run off because it's just so crazy. And the man who has the video camera just sort of flipped and ran and dropped it and ran off. And so they only had still pictures of him on the wire. There was no video footage of him sort of strolling up and down, unfortunately. But in some ways that sort of maybe even adds to it, because it's become sort of even more unforgettable somehow, rather than footage, which just sort of brings it down to earth, maybe. Yeah, to use that.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's just such an amazing, powerful film, really, and just such an amazing act of kind of crazy, but in a beautiful, really beautiful way. Just an extraordinary thing to pull off, kind of like, you know, putting a man on the moon or something. You know, it's like this kind of extraordinary feat.
Yeah.
Of just, you know, just I'm going to do this. It's crazy. I'm probably going to get killed, but I'm just going to do this. And it's, you know, amazing. And I can't recommend this film highly enough to people that you should, if you've not seen it.
He looks a little bit like Bruce Lee, because he's very sort of, you know, well-built or sort of fit.
Yeah, like he's a sort of a small, thin guy, but very wiry and obviously very fit. And sort of, you know, you can just see the, you know, and just the act itself, just the intense concentration that you would need to have to be able to maintain your balance and your, just because you can see just like people who are just on the peripheries freak out and run off. But this guy actually was the one who was doing it, like putting himself out there on that wire.
Yeah.
Such an incredible act of, you know, I mean, you could say crazy, but, you know, I kind of say that flippantly, but it's also an incredible, courageous act as well, isn't it? And peak sort of experience to have. Like to just defying everything just to go out there and do that. So it's quite an amazing thing. Not that I'm recommending that people should go out and string wires between buildings and start doing it.
Well,
obviously, he was very, you know, he practiced a lot and was very, very focused on what he was trying to achieve. So I wouldn't recommend that people do it.
No, that's one thing about this film. I feel like the authorities don't have to worry that there's going to be a rash of copycats. Not only the fact that the towers aren't there, but even if there were there, nobody would want to do this.
I mean, that's what's so extraordinary about it, because I think it is such an act of total. It's like the when we talked about Fitzcarraldo and that idea of moving the boat over the mountain, and it's that kind of it's kind of a mad dream, obsessively, that he just had to do it.
Yeah,
he just set his mind to doing something, and he just had to do it, even though for most people it would be, you know, that's crazy, man. Dude, that's nuts, man. You ain't gonna you'll kill yourself. But anyway,
well, one person says, I think it's his girlfriend says early on, c'est magnifique. Like, that's very very true. And later on, that I wrote down, somebody described this un buffet d'air. I think meaning a sort of buffet, like a feast of the air, which I thought seems to sum it up, if I understand that correctly. You know, it was a sort of just a crazy statement of some sort, and nobody really knows what it means. So, you know.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to make your own mind up about that. And that's, again, that's what makes it kind of so special.
Yeah.
Well, Jonathan, we planned it. We I think we got away with it.
I hope so.
But we've pulled off another intense podcast discussion about two really great films.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can we've convinced a few people out there, if they haven't seen these films already, to go and check them out.
There's this really interesting article in The Guardian written by Duncan Campbell, who was one of the gangsters who took part in the great train robbery in the UK in the 60s. And he sort of says, asks this question, is Man on Wire a heist movie? And it's quite a diverting article, which I'm not terribly long, which I'd recommend. And he sort of mentions a few other sort of heist movies, which he thinks of when watching it. Deadfall, which has got Michael Caine in it, and Kaleidoscope, which has Warren Beatty in it.
Well, definitely, folks, let us know what your favorite heist movies are, because we want to hear about it. Drop us a line. By all means, reach out to us and let us know what you're thinking about these films or anything that we talked about on the show, or if you know how Philippe paid for his little escapade. I don't know why, but I just want to know how they managed to pull that off. And we'll be back, despite the intensity, the raw intensity and the overwhelming experience of recording this podcast. I think Jonathan and I, our friendship is strong enough that we will, in fact, return again in a couple of weeks to talk about some more films.
Yep.
And we've got some other guests and things that we're lining up as well to talk about in future episodes. But stay tuned to find out more about that when it happens. The best way to do that is to either follow or subscribe to the show. And then as soon as it happens, you're going to know about it. Go and check these movies out. We didn't mention Man on a Wire. Man on Wire, not Man on a Wire. It's just called Man on Wire. And the film, you can get a Blu-ray. Sorry, I'll try and get that into focus for you. But that's Man on Wire. So it is available on Blu-ray. And also, I think it is pretty easily accessible from what I can tell on most of the main streaming services. So if you it's available as a rental, so you can go out there if you don't want to buy a disc and you just want to watch the film, just rent it on you know, YouTube or Amazon. Or
but it does have 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, so
there you go.
You know, you may want to buy it.
That's a lot of Rotten Tomatoes, isn't it?
That's those are fresh tomatoes. That's pretty.
But yeah, it's crack. It's a cracking good film, and so is Cash on Demand, folks. So go and search them out and find them, because you won't regret it. It'd be a great night's entertainment. Set Disney Plus aside for one night and watch these instead, because you'll be highly rewarded for it.
Definitely.
And on that note, Jonathan, nice to see you. Nice to talk to you.
Yes, sir.
And we will see you in a couple of weeks, folks. Thanks for tuning in wherever you are. take care. I hope you're doing well.
I'm going to just put on my disguise now so nobody will know who I am as I exit the building.
And we'll put on our overcoats and our cleaners' uniforms and then sneak out the back.
Yeah, another one here too.
I'll create a diversion, and then you make your way out the back, Jonathan, and I'll meet you at the rendezvous point, right back here in 2 weeks to talk about more cool films. So until then, folks, we'll see you soon.
See you soon.
Bye.
Oh, the things these nerdy middle-aged men get up to.